On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, another installment of Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland. The National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities are two of 17 federal agencies that appear to be targeted by the Trump administration for elimination. Last month, 24 senators sent a letter to the president urging him to keep funding for the NEA and NEH. Today, a conversation about public funding for the arts and the role of the arts in education. What does it cost? What should it accomplish? And who should pay for it? We're joined by Phoebe Stein, the executive director of Maryland Humanities, Paige Hernandez, a playwright and choreographer who's working with kids inside and outside the classroom, and the sculptor and arts advocate Marianne Mears, who's working to avert cuts in arts programs in Baltimore schools. First, the news. And good afternoon. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. It's time for another edition of Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. Today, a conversation about public funding of the arts and how federal, state, and local budgets reflect the priorities of President Donald Trump, Governor Larry Hogan, and Mayor Catherine Pugh. If you're a teaching or a performing artist, you are wondering if your future will include funding from federal, state, and local governments. The National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities are two of 17 federal agencies that appear to be targeted by the Trump administration for elimination, as its budget inclinations lean heavily towards defense spending and other priorities. The state of Maryland funded arts institutions at the highest level ever last year, and despite projecting a large budget deficit for next year, the governor has proposed an additional $1 million, bringing the allocation for the arts to $21 million in fiscal year 2018. Ironically, Baltimore City schools are facing drastic cuts, and as always, when school principals are looking to trim expenses, their gaze often falls first, however reluctantly, on music and visual arts programs. An organization called Arts Every Day is holding a symposium this weekend that will call attention to the role that arts education plays in boosting attendance, improving test scores, and making schools vibrant parts of their communities. Today, let's talk about what the arts can do for kids and their parents and grandparents and guardians. And let's talk about what the arts cost and whether or not that cost is worth it when belts are being tightened locally and nationally. Dr. Sherry Parks is an associate dean for research, interdisciplinary scholarship, and programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park, where she's also an associate professor in the Department of American Studies. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Hey, Sherry, it's good to see you, as always.
Good to see you.
So the Trump administration has said, has not said specifically that they're going to cut the National Endowment and the National National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities. One of the agencies that's on this list of possible cuts includes the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and we're in the middle of a pledge drive here at WIPR. We've been talking a lot about the role of government funding versus individual funding. CPB, full disclosure, accounts for about 7% of the WIPR budget. The vast majority of our budget comes from listeners who've been very generous so far in this pledge campaign, as they have been on other campaigns. National Endowment, again, the Trump administration has not said specifically they're going to do this, but it looks like they're looking to a Heritage Foundation report that recommends doing this. What's your understanding and what's your take on their approach to this?
Well, what has been said is that there is a blueprint that calls for the total elimination of both the NEA and the NEH. The last I was able to find out, and I was finding out yesterday, neither of the chairs has been directly contacted to say that the agencies are due for elimination. It would have to go through Congress. So right now, although it's not a formal period, there is a period of public discussion. People are contacting Congress. Congress are beginning to weigh in. And so we're in this right in the middle of the larger conversation.
The director of budget policy and the deputy director of the Domestic Policy Council is a guy named Paul Winfrey, and he's an economist from the Heritage Foundation. And the Heritage Foundation is the think tank, generally considered a conservative organization. They're the think tank that has come up with this so-called blueprint for balance, and they call for the elimination of the NEH, the NEA, and, as we say, 15 other agencies that are not all arts related. One of them is the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. One of them is the Office of Abuse of Women, mm-hmm. which interestingly gets more than twice the funding. It's something like $482 million as opposed to the $150 million or so, $151 million, that goes to the NEH and the NEA. So this is part of a large group, a very interesting group of cuts. It's not just the arts.
Right.
And they got to balance a budget where they want to spend $54 billion more dollars on defense spending.
Well, and first I have to do full disclosure. As you might imagine, being an associate dean in the College of Arts and Humanities, universities get grants from both agencies, and I'm co-PI on several grants that are coming from the National Endowment.
And the PI means you're a principal.
I'm sorry, investigator.
Yeah. In other words, the person who's going to spend the money.
Well, who's orchestrating the work too, and so I have to be clear is that when we're talking about arts, the creation of arts, we're talking about NEA. The humanities are the critique of the arts and using literature and history and scholarship in different ways. And so there's a kind of bright, clear line there. But as you just pointed out, the change in the budget would be minuscule. This really isn't about economics. One danger, though, is that in the negotiation in Congress that they become bargaining chips because they're highly symbolic.
Yeah, so some horse trading could happen
yes.
over this, as has happened in the past, frankly.
Yes,
it's been threatened with both of these agencies, the NEH and the NEA, Humanities and Arts. I have been threatened with closure before. This is not brand new by any means.
No, it's not brand new. It's different in some ways because both agencies have worked very hard to do what they call a public turn. That signature artworks really is the public turn, and the NEH has a whole division of public humanities. They're not necessarily disassociated from what we think of as the finer work, and I hope we get into that there's really a very close relationship between the two, particularly when you're talking about underserved populations. But it's almost ironic that in the last 5 years, both of them have worked really hard to show the influence of art and the influence of humanities in the public square.
Let's talk a little bit then about what it does. And I can also join in your disclosure that because for a little while longer, I'm the music director of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society and have been for a long time. And we are funded by the Maryland State Arts Council. We're funded by the Baltimore County Commission on the Arts. We're funded mm-hmm. by the National Endowment for the Arts for specific projects that we do, concerts and programs that we do.
Well, and we are in good local company. National Endowment for the Humanities, I checked, and for the last 10 years, there's been $29 million that has come into Maryland. And for NEA, there's been $8 million, most of that through the Maryland State Arts Council.
And what have we gotten for that?
Oh, well, how long do you have?
Just under an hour.
Well, and obviously, I mean, I value this work very deeply, but I wouldn't be talking about it if I thought it was just kind of a partisan or individual thing. Two-thirds of the work that NEA does is in small towns and small organizations. So often the image is that it's the big organizations that get the bulk of the money, and that actually isn't true. That if you're talking about a small town in Western Maryland, Eastern Shore, the only public art sometimes or the only public humanities is coming through the federal agency. So that's what we're talking about. We're also talking about in Baltimore, like of Orchids, which is having music lessons for children who may not be getting it in school.
It's a program by the Baltimore Symphony.
Right, our young audiences who does work that way. Baltimore Stories, which I am the program director for that has gone into working class black communities and talked about stories and narratives. We just also just got an NEH that services recently arrived immigrant youth. And so people think of the high art or the historian working in his garret, but excuse me, most of the money goes to underserved populations and underserviced communities.
And that's an interesting dimension of this conversation, given the presidential campaign that we've just been through, because Mr. Trump carried the rural vote by a tremendous margin. Secretary Clinton carried, you know, we talk about the left coast and the right coast. It was something like 500 counties, if you divvy it up that way. You can divvy this up a whole bunch of ways, congressional districts. Mrs. Clinton carried 500 counties. That represents about 64% of the American economy. And Mr. Trump carried 2,500 counties, and it represents exurbia and the rural part of the country. They are a big reason, big part of the reason that Mr. Trump is in office. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for example, funds about 7% of the budget here at WIPR. But for some of the rural stations, both public TV and public radio, it funds sometimes 100%.
Yes.
So if cutting CPB would eliminate the access, the accessibility of public broadcasting in large swaths of rural America. When we talk about this era of fake news and the era of information that needs to be carefully curated and looked at in a discriminating way, this would only perpetuate that problem, would it not? I mean, if all of a sudden you couldn't hear the NPR broadcasts in large parts of rural America, you know, their choices for information sources are going to be severely limited.
I think often people do not know the source of the funding for the services they have because they don't splash their name all over the products that come from their funding. And you have to look at the end and see the little logo. Let me follow your argument for a minute, that the founding fathers said that first you have to have an unfettered press and you have to have a citizenry who that is knowledgeable. And the arts and humanities are part of that knowledge. If you think about what the humanities do in terms of allowing and fostering an analytical critique, not necessarily criticism, but critique. And if you and I and many people know that art with an idea is really, really powerful. You're talking about pulling those capabilities out of communities that sorely need them right now.
It's interesting. The genesis of the National Endowment for the Arts and the Humanities, it was 1965.
Same stroke of the pen.
Very interesting year, too. Mm-hmm. The same year that Congress created Medicare and Medicaid, same year that they passed the Voting Rights Act. I mean, there was a lot going on. It's President Johnson. And the idea at that point was to invest in culture the way we invested in science.
Yes.
Is that an argument that holds water today? Is funding the arts an investment, you know, that there's going to be this direct return on in the way that we invest in other things?
Well, and now is a really interesting time to ask that question, because there certainly has been the thought since Plato that that arts and culture could influence people. Now, and you're right in my research wheelhouse right now in terms of what art and culture do, there's lots of data-driven evidence about what art and culture can do in an individual life, can do in a community, can do nationally. We know how art as strategy works. We know how cultural conversations, deep cultural conversations work. And it's really interesting. And I'm going to talk about Baltimore Stories for a minute now because of the work that we've done.
And this is a series that grew out of the uprising in April 2015.
It grew out of the uprising. Our major partners are Maryland Humanities, Enoch Pratt, UMBC and GBCA, and we staged 20 events in 9 months, deep community conversations. Since then, there have been 5 other grant proposals that 3 of them scientific, that make use of Baltimore Stories. So of that idea and
so
that work.
So it becomes a data trove Well, were people doing research?
And what's, well, what's
to
really,
a certain extent?
Well, what's really interesting is, and NEH and NEA work in some ways in my mind, so blame me for this cockamamie idea, as kind of like patent offices. So there is an idea. They endorse it or not. They say, this is useful. This is well thought out. You know, go do it. And because of that, when they give a grant, often those grants then become leveraged and yield other money. And in some cases for public humanity, the ratio is 8-1. I mean, in terms of other funds that come into community, because the NEH has said that. And the same with the arts.
So in terms of investing, that's a pretty good return on investment. All right. More on this with Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland. She joins me in the studio for this edition of Culture Connection. Thanks to everybody who has made a pledge to support WYPR, and this our spring membership campaign. Speaking of investments, if you have yet to make a pledge, now's a great time to do just that. And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, a conversation about the impact of race on wealth accumulation. A new report called The Asset Value of Whiteness looks at the national scene, and there's another report called The Racial Wealth Divide in Baltimore. That one examines the problem here in our city. We'll have the authors of both of those reports, along with A. Adar Ayira of Associated Black Charities, to talk about inequality when it comes to what we make and what we're able to save. If you've just joined us today, it's the March installment of Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Park. She's an associate dean and an associate professor at the University of Maryland. We're talking about proposals to abolish the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities, along with other federal agencies. You are welcome to join our conversation. The number to call to join midday is different than the number to call to make a pledge. If you want to make a pledge, we're always up for that idea. That number again, 410-235-1395. If you want to join midday today and talk about proposed cuts in the arts, we're at 410-662-8780. That's 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at wypr.org, and our Twitter handle at midday. Tom Hall. So, Sherry, I want to move to a mutual buddy of ours, Phoebe Stein, who joins us on the line from Washington, D.C., where she's down there today. She is the executive director of Maryland Humanities. Phoebe, welcome to Midday.
Hi, guys. So glad to be with you.
So if the National Endowment for the Humanities were to be eliminated, what would that mean for Maryland Humanities?
Well, I'm going to take a broader picture, if that's okay with you. I will answer your question as well. But I would say that just as a reminder, these sister organizations, NEH and NEA, you know, what does NEH do? What other things would go away if NEH goes away? They are the folks who brought you King Tut in the 70s. They bring you the Ken Burns films. And by they bring you, I mean they have core funding that supports these. They're also preserving and digitizing all of the nation's newspapers. These are just kinds of things that NEH does. Here in Maryland, what do? They support, of course, the Baltimore Museum of Industry, Loyola University programs, some programs at the Walters, exhibits, wonderful exhibits there, University of Maryland, where Sherry is, Towson, and of course, our State Humanities Council, Maryland Humanities. So it would, you know, that core support, we are a nonprofit organization, but we're a public-private partnership. So what it means is that our federal funding, our core federal funding goes away, and we have fewer programs, we have fewer staff, and really we're not meeting the need that we're seeing in Maryland for free lifelong learning in the humanities. So, you know, that's just means that we can not serve as many people as we do, and we're already seeing that there's a great demand. There's more demand than we can fulfill, actually, for these free educational programs, lifelong learning in the humanities.
So, Phoebe, there are those who oppose public funding for organizations like Maryland Humanities or the Arts Council. And the argument is that these programs should be self-sustaining, that they should simply find people in the private sector who say, yep, this is important.
Yep.
We'll do this. We don't need the government. We don't need tax.
Right.
You know, we don't need taxpayers to be compelled to support them.
Right.
What do you say to that?
So here's what I've been saying today on the Hill. We, including in-kind support, we leverage those federal dollars four times over. So really, we are not just there with our handout for the federal funding. We feel that federal funding is appropriate and necessary. I don't know if you guys have already quoted the founding legislation for NEH and NEA, but what it says is, democracy demands wisdom and vision in its citizens. And a federal investment is a federal investment in local communities. You guys have talked about that, many of them rural. And it also is an investment in an informed citizenry and a stronger democracy. And I would say that folks on every, I'm not going to even talk about sides of the aisle, just from every perspective, I'm hearing that folks want to be more informed and they would like a stronger democracy.
Sherry Parks, the rationale given in this blueprint for balance from the Heritage Foundation, which evidently the Trump administration is taking quite seriously. And again, we need to be clear, the Trump administration has not come out and said, we're doing this. They've just, there's a lot of indication that says that this is something that they're considering quite seriously. The rationale for eliminating the endowments of arts and humanities is that private individuals and organizations should be able to donate at their own discretion to these organizations and these programs. Government should not use its coercive power of taxation to compel taxpayers to support cultural organizations. And they say that regardless of how much NEH has dispersed since 1965, and it's somewhere in the order of $5.3 billion, that those funds dwarf private giving. So there's people doing this already. They're saying essentially this isn't necessary. The money would be found some other place. In your experience as a person who's applied for grants and who's raised money for programs, I mean, is that resonate with your personal experience?
Well, it's not additive in that way. As both Phoebe and I have said, is that that the federal money allows you to leverage the private money, but specific private money. If you go back to what was going on before the 1960s, if you go back to basically a patronage system, then you get the art, you get the culture that particular individuals want. And some of that is useful to poor people, some of it's not. And so what the government agency work does is to refocus some of that attention toward other types of things, because you have to have people who are willing to go into the communities, who are willing to do that work, who are willing to talk to people who don't have much power and money, and put those people in conversations. So it's a different focus. And what the legislation was working to do, what the bill was working to do, was to democratize art. And there's, over centuries, there's been an emphasis on art and culture for the wealthy. And that is actually what we're talking about returning to.
And I just add one thing on that, Tom? This is Phoebe. I just want to say, you know, we do receive at Maryland Humanities, we have wonderful individual donors. I'm also a member of WIPR, and I can put a plug out for being a member of WIPR, do it today. But, you know, we have doubled the number of donors over the past few years that give to us. We have corporation and foundation support, but all of it works together. And the state of Maryland supports us as well. But the federal, the state, and the local support all works together so that we can reach the scale of what we're talking about. We're reaching 40,000 middle and high school students right now because of this combination of funding sources. And also to the point of who are we reaching, we are reaching veterans. We are in hospitals. We are in working with incarcerated populations and in many different types of communities all across the state. But because of that combination of federal funding and the state and the local, the private.
And I should say, I certainly didn't mean to appear to demonize private giving. It's very important. It's very useful. There needs to be a balance.
Well, Phoebe Stein, I know you're busy on the Hill today talking and advocating for this very topic. So I appreciate your time today. Thanks very much. And we'll see you soon.
Thank you. I want to say one other thing, that the federal government invested in a little thing called the Library of Congress in 1800. So there is a long and rich history of federal investment in our arts and our culture. And thank you for having me on today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Phoebe. And, of course, the Library of Congress now being run by our own Carla Hayden, whom we claim, even though she's from Chicago. I want to move now to Mary Ann Mears. She's a sculptor and a longtime arts advocate. She founded and she remains a trustee of a group called Arts Education in Maryland Schools Alliance, and she's part of a steering committee of the Baltimore Arts Education Coalition. I want to talk a little bit about Baltimore schools. Mary Ann, welcome to Midday.
Thank you, Tom, and hello, Sherry.
Hi.
So talk about the cuts that are anticipated in the Baltimore City schools in terms of arts programs. There are a lot of folks in the school system thinking that that's going to appear to be, to some principals, the sort of low-hanging fruit when it comes to tough budget choices that they've got to make.
And the difficulty is that right now, unless the state and the city come up with $42 million, Dr. Santelis has said she has to let go of 1,000 staff members, and many of whom would be teachers. And we know from history that that means many arts teachers. In fact, that's been called out in all of the press coverage of this. And the difficulty is it is compounded by the fact that we are actually way below where we should be currently in terms of arts positions. So we've had a slide in the number of arts teachers, and we actually, thanks to Dr. Santelis's transparency and openness, we actually got data on that. So we know that we had in 2007-08, we had 373 arts teachers, and I'm talking about art, music, theater, visual arts, media arts, and dance, and we are now at 218. And that's 180 schools, so that means we have some schools that don't have any art or music, so that, for example, 86 of our schools have not had a music teacher for 4 years. 38 have had no visual arts teachers in the last 4 years. So what we're looking at is a situation, and this is across whether it's traditional schools, charter schools, they're all roughly in the same place, which is if they have an arts teacher, they only have one, and in many cases, as I said, we have a number around 30, I think it is 20-something, that have no arts teachers at all.
So, Marianne, what do you say to the legislator or the policymaker who says, well, you know, that's too bad. It would be nice if the kids could, you know, sing in the chorus or play in the band or learn how to paint. But the real issue in schools is STEM, science and technology, math, English literacy and, you know, comprehension, and that we've got to just stick to the basics. We've got to concentrate on teaching kids how to compute and how to read and write.
Well, interestingly, actually, at both the federal and the state level, the arts are defined as core, and it's been understood for a long time that the arts are absolutely essential for a well-rounded education. There's wonderful research, cognitive science, neuroscience, that really explains why the arts are so powerful in helping children learn and retain information. And because people realize that, in Maryland, and I've been working on the advocacy for the arts education statewide, in Maryland, we've made enormous strides in some of our systems. So, for example, in Prince George's County right now, they're building their arts program, and they have, for example, in Baltimore City, we have no one in central office currently in charge of the arts. The position, there was one position, and it's currently vacant. In Prince George's County, they have 13 people coordinating the arts programs across that district. And our surrounding counties, Anne Arundel, Baltimore County, 7, 8, they have twice as many arts teachers in all of those jurisdictions on a teacher-student basis than we do. So the other jurisdictions have recognized the validity of that research. And the other thing that happens, Tom, is parents vote with their feet. And we have been in the process
and
of trying
they
to
choose
strengthen
to leave
our schools
right.
and attract more families to Baltimore.
Right.
And it makes it very, very difficult because they will not, people who have other options will not go to schools without the arts.
All right, well, Marianne Mears, let me ask you to hold on. We're going to take a little break and talk about our current pledge campaign here at WIPR. If you could hold on, we will come back to you after the break. We're also going to be joined by Paige Hernandez. She's an award-winning arts teacher. She's a hip-hop artist, a theater person, a playwright, and a choreographer. And I'm joined here in the studio by Dr. Sherry Parks. Her latest book is called Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. She joins us once a month for Culture Connections. We want to thank everybody who has connected with WIPR and become a member in this spring membership campaign. The number to call, 410-235-1395. You can go online to wypr.org. I'm joined again by Andy Bienstock, our program director. And Andy, the fact that these uncertain times when it comes to government funding does sort of up the ante a little bit in at this particular period for individual donations to public radio. And thanks for joining us again for Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Dr. Sherry Parks joins me for this month installment of Culture Connections. We're talking about the National Endowment for the Arts and the Humanities. They are among 17 agencies, including the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which are being considered for elimination by the Trump administration. We'll try, if we can, in the limited time we have left, to get to some of your phone calls. If you want to call and become part of Midday, that number, 410-662-8780. That's a different number than you call to pledge to WIPR. And thanks again to everybody who has made that decision so far in this spring membership campaign. That number, 410-235-1395. Our email at Midday is midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall. So, Sherry Parks, when I talk to folks who own businesses in Baltimore, they say it's really tough finding enough people to fill the workforce that we need to develop when it comes to kids graduating from local schools. Is there any data about how the community feels about that, the business?
And there's lots. And it comes from places like the National Chamber of Commerce and the RAND Corporation, places that you might not expect to be thinking about arts and culture. And it's related to having a knowledgeable workforce. As you said, there are lots of companies that have said, well, I'd love to move into Baltimore, but Maryland, but there's not a knowledgeable workforce. And what they're talking about is the ability to be analytical and critical and to move, not just to turn that widget, but to understand the idea behind the widget. And if you look at the difference between public schools and private schools, you'll see that they use art and culture, art and stories, to move ideas through. So we know that that expanded and integrated information, when it's tied with art and culture, leads to a larger understanding, a more knowledgeable workforce. And that's what businesses are calling for. And they're calling specifically for students who have more experience with art and culture. They said, we will teach them how to turn the widgets. We want them to understand the concepts behind them so that they can move from job to job to job.
Let's turn now to Paige Hernandez. She's going to be the keynote speaker at a symposium that takes place on Saturday. As a matter of fact, Sherry Parks, you're going to be a moderator, one of the panels. This is produced by an organization called Arts Every Day. Paige Hernandez is a dancer, a performer, and an artist teacher. She joins us on the line from Washington. Mr. Dandis, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. Hi, Tom. Hi, Sherry.
Hi.
So talk about the work that you do and whether or not the work you do as a dancer and choreographer and a playwright, the work you do with kids, are you seeing direct correlation between the work they're doing with you and the success they may be having in other subjects, the sort of straight academic subjects, you know, math and English, that kind of thing?
Oh, certainly. So much so that I've made it my personal mission for myself, as well as for my company, B-Fly Entertainment, to stand on a foundation of arts integration. I've seen firsthand, including personally, what it means to be able to integrate arts with the curriculum and how the results are really impactful and meaningful. And for me, they actually soared. So all of the shows that I originally create and produce usually have some type of education component tied into it, specifically with the arts integration. Earlier, you were talking about STEM and the need for STEM education, where I really have an approach that leans more towards STEAM, which is including arts in that acronym for science, technology, engineering, and math.
And talk a little bit about the kind of work that you do. When you go into a classroom, what do you do with the kids?
Sure.
And that's easy. Take 30 seconds to, you know, tell us the entire purpose of your life. Right?
Sure. So my company specializes in multi-generational and multicultural hip-hop theater experiences. And then what I do is I go into the classroom, and not only do I use arts integration, but I use the approach of hip-hop to really speak to the students in a way that validates them and relates to them while they're still learning the entire time. So that's essentially what I do. In doing that, I've seen, like I said, the results kind of soar in different places, especially for students with special needs, as well as English second language students. It's really just an approach that's multitonal. So I'm very excited to talk more about that with Arts Every Day in their 10th anniversary, which they're celebrating this weekend at the symposium on Saturday. And anyone is welcome to come. There's still tickets available.
Great.
If you take art as a specific example, what you learn when you dance, you learn problem solving, you learn coordination with other people, which is teamwork. You're actually resilience in terms of what are the conditions I find on the ground, if the floor sprung or not, and how do I jump differently because of that. All of those tie into the person, and the ability to memorize a routine is a type of learning and a way to learn things. And if you say teach rote learning with dance instead, kids learn it faster and for a longer period of time.
And Marianne Mears, you're working as part of the steering committee of the Baltimore Arts Education Coalition. Do you make the argument to the school board in Baltimore City, to funders in Annapolis, funders in the city government, that test scores are going to improve if the kids have arts? Because right now the test scores in Baltimore City are not something that anybody's proud of. Is this part of the argument that you're making?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that I talked before about research, and one of the most important pieces of research actually shows that kids from disadvantaged backgrounds, lower SES, social economic status, actually get more of a bang for the buck from having arts instruction. It boosts their performance in school enormously. And what Paige was talking about and what Cherry has said, all of those things are arguments that we bring. And we often have students themselves talk about what the arts have meant to their wanting to be in school and succeeding. And we've appeared before the school board last week. I was down in Annapolis testifying in the Budget and Taxation Committee hearing yesterday. And I just want to make sure that everyone knows that it's a really critical moment to reach out to Governor Hogan, members of the legislature, and to our Mayor Catherine Pugh, because unless the money is put back, arts teachers are going to be let go. And there's a real deadline for that, and it's the end of this month. So everyone should be reaching out. And that's short term. Long term, there's something called the Kerwin Commission. We are working with them to define what adequate funding is in terms of providing what the state says should be provided for children in the arts in the regulation. And we are also working with the school system on doing a long-range plan. And the symposium on Saturday is actually a wonderful opportunity to inform that process. So
right.
I want to
obviously the formula for funding. Yeah, the formula issue is one that we'll take up. A quick comment as we got to finish up here.
Well, and you can make there is comparable evidence for instance, history, that if children know the heritage of their own people, they know their history, their test scores rise.
And Paige Hernandez, just one last quick comment. It seems to me that what's crucial here is that arts teachers are also going to have to be hipper. They're going to have to be trained in ways outside of just their thing. You know, you can't just say, "Well, I'm a painter. I'm going to go teach painting." That you're going to need to be able to do the kinds of integrative things that you're doing in the classroom.
Yes, we all have the tools and resources to really reach the students in a way that's unique to us. But I definitely encourage everyone to look outside of the box and look at different approaches that are fresh and new and relative, and again, that speak to the current generation of students.
All right. Well, Paige Hernandez, thank you for your time. Marianne Mears, thank you for yours as well. And Sherry Parks, always a pleasure. Thank you for yours, and we'll see you next month.
Thank you.
Dr. Sherry Parks joins us once a month for Culture Connections here on Midday. She's an Associate Dean for Research, Interdisciplinary Scholarship, and Programming at the College of Arts and Humanities in the University of Maryland in College Park. That's it for us today. Tomorrow, a look at race and wealth disparities. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers, locations and hours at joesquared.com. Thanks to everybody who has made a pledge in this, our spring membership campaigns.